What I'm going to do is share some insights with you from my doctoral research and research since then on the use of informal value transfer systems for supporting terrorist finance and the transfer of funds. So it's a little bit different from raising funds, it's about moving funds. And I didn't want to assume that people perhaps didn't know what an informal value transfer system was or looked like. So in terms of what FATFA defined them as, and because FATFA is important in this context because of the regulation that these systems are now subject to, FATFA has described them as a distinct category of non-financial institution. That's their definition. They've also recognised there are systems or networks that have links to specific geographical locations, and they are used by particular ethnic communities. That's the other characteristic that they've had. But more recently, FATFA has redesigned its definition in late 2013, to Hawala and other service providers, in recognition that over the last 10 years or so, there's been increasing regulation of these systems at national level, and that they recognise that Hawala still operates, but it's mainly in contexts where it's unregulated or there's lack of regulatory enforcement. And there are other categories they helpfully look at as regulated, but wittingly or unwittingly misused. So they're coming at it from one perspective, really. They're not really looking at why informal value transfer systems have survived, because they originated quite some time ago, and why they're used. And they're used largely by the migrant diaspora to remit funds back home to support populations in countries where they once were resident. And it's for economic purposes and social purposes, because there are countries in this world where people don't have a pension, they have to pay for health, they have to pay for education, and they rely on family support to do that. When you live in a country where you're provided with a lot of those resources from the taxes you pay and state support, you forget that other communities don't have that. So developing countries rely on this funding coming in. So informal value transfer systems, I apologise if people are already familiar with this, but I didn't want to go on without having ascribed basically how they operate. So if you already know this, I apologise, and it's for those people who might not be familiar. You've got two Hawala operators operating in different jurisdictions, and you've got a sender and recipient. How it works is the sender takes the money, they say, I want to send 50 quid to my granny in wherever, Pakistan, and they give it to the operator. The payment is taken by the operator, a unique code usually. It could be something idiosyncratic to that transaction that they come up with, but it could be a banknote, could be a passport number, could be a bank account number, could be a date of birth. That is given to the hawalador. The sender then gives it to the recipient uses it to collect it from the hawalador, who's given it from the partner hawalador in the other jurisdiction, and the money's picked up and collected. Now, without regulation, the problem is that there's no scrutiny of who's involved in these systems. There's no scrutiny of the sender, there's no scrutiny of the beneficiary, the recipient, there's no scrutiny of the people who are acting as transfers and custodians of this money. And if it all goes wrong and your money disappears, as a customer you've got no comeback, have you? Because you're generally not given receipts, and that's the way it operates, all very informally. The other thing is it creates a debt between the hawaladors, which then means it needs to be paid back in some way. And usually that would be done by reverse transactions, but they're not likely to be remittances, because remittances tend to be unidirectional. They tend to be from developing countries to undeveloped countries in terms of support, where there's legitimate activity. It could be legitimate activity coming back in terms of trade, but as the work by Nikos Passas has shown, there often is an element of money laundering along there in terms of trade-based laundering, in terms of under-invoicing to offset that transaction payment back. That settlement process and that consolidation process is fairly complicated. This is a simple model of a traditional operation that doesn't go through the formal sector. But in modern times, these systems have intersected with the formal sector, and they're much more complicated. There's layers and layers and layers of individuals involved. And at higher level within these networks, the hawaladors will consolidate their payments to engage in that process. There'll be a consolidation of lots of payments made here and lots of debts owed there, and they'll be paid off. But they're paid off over periods of time, not in the same amounts that reflect the original transaction. So you can see how difficult it would be for external authorities to know that A, this was going on, B, recognise it, and C, recognise what the transaction represented, and for any scrutiny of that, if there was an illicit purpose in mind, and if it was going to be potentially misused for terrorist finance, that would be the concern. So why is this the problem? Well, in terms of worldwide remittances, there's 401 billion a year remitted through the formal system, that's including in balance of payments figures. For the UK, 65% of our outgoing remittances are to developing countries. And to give you an idea of what that involves, India, we remit 3.9 million, same to Nigeria, and I think to Pakistan, we remit 1.6. So that's the remittances that go through the formal sector. The informal flows, absent regulation before that, have been very difficult to qualify. And they're estimated between anything from 35 to 75%. So it is an area of concern. And particularly, it's an area of concern because of the risk these systems create, because the membership of these systems by the operators is on trust. You enter the system because you have community standing, because you are recognised socially, because you have commercial interests, because you have shared interests within the community, and there's also a concern that perhaps there might be shared ethnic and religious concerns as well might play a role in this, although there's little evidence to support that. But those have been the unspoken concerns about these systems. And post 9/11, they came in for a lot of attack in terms of the increased security of these systems, particularly as they initially thought to be responsible for transferring money in relation to the 9/11 attacks, although that allegation was never substantiated. So the problem that these systems pose is how to manage the risks in terms of the lack of standardisation of record keeping, the lack of transparency of transactions, the lack of control over personnel who operate in these systems, and the lack of scrutiny of those people using these systems and where the money's going for and what purpose. So with that in mind, FATFA special recommendation was suggested in 2003, and that was an international standard that required states who are FATFA members, and there's quite a considerable number of those, to ensure that all money value and transmission service was subject to formal regulation, either licensing or registration. And as they were regulated, they would be subject to all the FATFA standards. Helpfully, FATFA didn't explain what they thought a licensing system would look like, or what the difference was between licensing and registration, or what any of the requirements of that might be. But they were happy that they would be subject to all the FATFA recommendations, and that they would be, should be compliance sanctions as well. So there should be civil and criminal sanctions should you not comply with the regulation. That's the basis for how these systems are now regulated. The aim was to drive financial intelligence as well as improve security of these systems as well, so that there would be some way of investigating any misuse of these systems potentially, given that there was an accusation that they hadn't actually had records. So that's a misnomer really, because these systems have kept records, even in an informal sense, but they're not records that are accessible. They're very idiosyncratic, and after the transactions they're often disposed of. So that's the context. Recently, the FATFA technical note in the for the UK, July 2011, as a follow-up to the assessment of the UK jurisdiction in 2007, has highlighted that both charities and MSPs, as they're now termed, under regulation, are still at high risk for terrorist finance and money laundering. So money laundering regulations, this is the bit that I chose in terms of looking at a regulation. You might be sitting and thinking, why are you talking about terrorist finance and then talking about the general money laundering tool? But the reason I chose this piece of legislation, because this is the framework that requires the systems to actually engage in due diligence activity and a risk-based approach. And this is the regulation that this piece of legislation actually regulates them and requires them to adhere to these conditions. So that's the context to sort of looking at this piece of legislation. A money service business also includes cheque cashing and bureau de change as well within the definition. And the Money Laundering Regulations 2007 actually apply the EU Directive 2005-60, the EC money laundering, Third Money Laundering Directive. So in terms of the definition of money service business, it includes those three kinds of activity. But remittances are don't have any possibility exemptions for occasional limited activity or by value. That only applies to the other categories. So they're not subject to any exemptions. There's a registration test in terms of those people managing the companies that are operating as money service businesses, apart from having to be registered, have to engage in a fit and proper test. So people who have obvious criminal convictions are excluded. But that was also amended in 2012 to add that they can be excluded or turned down for registration, or even deregistered on the basis that they are posing a risk in terms of money laundering and terrorist finance. And that might also include things like they've been subject to several audits by the regulator, HMRC, and haven't engaged in that process sufficiently. They apply a risk-based approach, as you made comment earlier, that that causes problems because that is a very vague piece of apparatus. It's designed to be proportionate so that businesses can assess their own risk, they can assess their own anti-money laundering and terrorist finance profile, they can appoint a money laundering officer that oversees the policy, that trains all the staff, that's responsible for receiving internal SARs, and they can analyse every part of their business in terms of customers, transactions, beneficiaries, jurisdictions they're operating in, and whether they think they're operating in a high-risk remittance corridor, like Somalia, or a low-risk corridor, possibly like Mexico, in comparison. But in terms of the risk-based approach, it does cause problems because the operators are very reliant upon the guidance to inform them. And as pointed out, residual risks leaves the operators being very nervous, the operators of these businesses being very nervous, because that's the risk that potentially is the bit that isn't managed and is still there. They also have to engage in jurisdictional assessments, and that's quite a complex process, I would say, to ask people who perhaps prior to regulation were operating a business as a one-man operative and suddenly subject to all this regulation. Doing a jurisdictional risk assessment is quite a complex thing. It's a challenge sometimes for the Treasury, never mind sort of an ordinary businessman. So they have to do part of their work, maybe having to risk assess the threat of terrorist finance on that corridor, as well as the partners they're engaging with at the end. But that's a requirement of fact from Recommendation 1 and forms part of the fourth EU directive that's proposed in terms of states now required to produce a money laundering and terrorist finance assessment, and the UK one is due out this year, but not yet. So they have to manage their money laundering and terror finance profile, and they also have to engage in SARs reporting in relation to general money laundering and also terrorist finance activity. They are also responsible for their overseas agency, making sure that they comply in the way they operate with UK standards, equivalent jurisdictions, and there are civil sanctions for non-compliance of regulatory breaches, and also criminal sanctions under the Crisis Crime Act and also the Terrorism Act 2000. So thinking about the numbers of MSBs that there are in the country, the latest figures I've got are 2011 figures, and it has shifted a little bit since then, and there were 3,628 MSBs, as they're termed under the legislation, operating in the UK. And they also have parallel registration now as well with the FCA under the payment services regulation as well, either as an authorised payment institution or a small payment institution. But that's not really, although the money laundering regulations impact on that, that's not really about managing the risk of money laundering. That's about prudential risk in terms of safeguarding activity and the separation of funds in these businesses in that sense. So thinking about the sort of numbers of MSBs and currently sort of the activity they're engaged in, there are 1,153 authorised payment institutions within the UK and about 300 small payment institutions. So that's how they've been divided under the FCA classification. So the impact of regulation then, what has this meant in practice in terms of the justification for regulating these systems seem to be concerns that were very much paramount after the 9/11 attacks, particularly the attitude of the US and some sanctioning of MSB providers. Has it led to being effective in terms of containing terrorist finance? Well, it's definitely led to increase in transparency, but it's also required an upskilling of operators in terms of their knowledge and awareness of what they've got to do in order to make this system work. You have to have quite a sensitive knowledge of risk of your business, and you have to be committed to that and reviewing that ongoing to be able to make the whole system work. These businesses have different sizes. They can be everything from a one-man operation to a small independent, an independent with several outlets that operates regionally. It could be a wholesale operator that services and supplies other money service businesses and consolidates payments for them. Or it could be a large principal high street brand that operates through agents, and agents themselves can have multi-agency contracts. So there's a lot of distinction between the sizes of business that change that. There's definitely increased formality. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does take away some of the valuable attributes that were characterised by the informality of the system in a sense, the accessibility. A lot of these businesses used to open all hours and perhaps, you know, don't do that now because there are cost implications. Operators used to be the same ethnicity of the corridors they service, and whilst that's still evident in some cases, it's not a necessity, and it's not perceived as something that's needed under the regulation. But help with language and interpretation was also an added advantage. So those things sometimes can be compromised where formality is there. Change in operational structures, yes, it has changed the market in terms of how these businesses operate. There's a disproportionate workload, and there is a cost to implementing the risk-based approach that is disproportionate on smaller businesses, which these tend to be predominantly. Trade-based laundering is unaffected in terms of that's hidden, that's not seen, that's not revealed necessarily by this process, unfortunately. And the risk-based approach is reliant upon supervisory guidance. And the Joint Money Laundering Steering Group guidance itself, the 2004 guidance for MSBs and the recent HMRC guidance, recognise as well the varied structure of the sector and the problems that creates in supervising and giving appropriate advice, because the supervisors have to know the sector and have to be able to give advice about the risks relevant to the different sizes of the businesses and the different activities they're engaged in. Because they're not all just engaged in remittances. About 45% of MSBs are actually engaged in one or more of those other activities like bureau de change or check cashing. There's little consideration of the cultural fit and financial inclusion, i.e. the purpose of remittances. Nobody's really thought about that. What is the effect on remittance activity for customers of having increased due diligence checks? And what are the effects on the sort of migrants in the UK or students if they haven't got the right documentation at the right time and they want to be able to receive money or send money? And the sector is very concerned about prosecution, particularly concerned, more concerned about that than civil sanctions. Effectiveness of regulation then, merger of the anti-money laundering counter-terrorist standards, is that a good thing? Thank you. Given that one of the things that have come out today is that we don't really have enough evidence base on terms of the success of the money laundering regime. There isn't enough data there to show that that's effective in yielding the results that we want. And we've also sort of spoke earlier about the purpose of the money laundering regime, revisiting that and looking at what that purpose is. Well, if we're still not sure about those, then the additional add-on of counter-terrorism as included within those standards adds a different dimension to it. And the danger is as well that when you have a security issue as sensitive as terrorist finance as well, it sometimes can be a reason for tightening standards. They're never going to become more lax, I would argue, and lowering threshold for risk tolerance. Prosecution of funding offences, in the period from 2001 to 2011, there have only been 16 prosecutions for terrorist funding offences in the Terrorist Act, Terrorism Act 2000. That's the funding offences, sections 15 to 19. Sometimes POCO general legislation is used. Seizure and forfeiture, very little data. There is a general deterrence principle here. The fact that these businesses are regulated does offer some general deterrence, but it's non-specific and you can't see the value of it. And it doesn't really incentivise those businesses who are putting a lot of effort into doing this to revisiting this constantly and amending and tweaking their sort of risk-based assessments on the basis of new risks that emerge, because they do. Due diligence and suspicion. Well, an easy answer would be to lower transaction thresholds, but that's not necessarily going to be always effective. You've got to match what that might achieve in terms of the risk that you're trying to address. Suspicion. How do you advise somebody this is going to be a terrorist transaction? What do they look for? There's evidence that people are looking at anti-money laundering indicators, and there's no evidence to suggest that they actually might be helpful in terms of revealing SARS. So why are we asking them to do it? And in terms of the SARS activity in this sector, although that's improved from 2012 to 2013, it's 9% for money service businesses, although they form the bulk of the terrorist finance SARS. So there are issues about SARS reporting, and also there are variable responses to risk. You can have different businesses and they will approach risk in a different way. It's a very individual thing. I used to work as a moving and handling supervisor, where I used to have to train people to spot risk in a clinical context in a hospital. And it always amazed me, though you could have a risk assessment and a framework, and it all could be quite nicely written down, that they would see risk in different ways. It's the same thing in the financial sector and within these businesses. And it was mentioned earlier, Well, Simon, I think you mentioned about FATFA approaching, looking at sort of reviewing their standard and their framework and looking at effectiveness, but they've yet to come up with a methodology to do that, and they say they're going to do it and they want to incorporate that into their future mutual evaluations, but they yet haven't fleshed out how they're going to do that, what sort of evidence they're going to require of states to measure that effectiveness. And Ramada has made a comment about that, that we need to show that these systems are effective. And there's little consideration proposed in financial inclusion. One of the things that was mentioned here by my colleagues was that the humanitarian efforts, these systems are extremely valuable at getting into areas where there are conflict, where there's famine, disaster, etc. And the Dabashul MSC case, where the Dabashul case took action against civil action against Barclays to seek an injunction preventing Barclays from removing their banking services, is a consequence of that risk-averse reaction that legislation has created as an unintended consequences. The banks see the MSC sector as very, very high risk and don't want to deal with them, even if they're registered, even if they're compliant, even if they've never breached any of the regulatory framework and have a clean bill of health from HMRC. And that is causing problems because the Dabashul company have 180 outlets in the UK. They have 400 in the Horn of Africa, particularly in Somalia, and they're used by 286 organisations, a lot of them doing charitable work. 2 minutes. Thank you.
No, we passed that.
All right, end. So the fact that this risk-averse environment has created a problem for MSB services in being declined the essential banking services that give to their function, it is an intended consequence of policy that needs to be addressed. The answer that I'm not going to get to is in multi-agency working groups that are now set up by the government, finally at last, sort of a good time after regulation has been enforced, to look at safe corridors, risk assessing those and helping MSBs develop an approach to working in high-risk corridors that guides jurisdictional assessments in a more purposeful way. And we've seen an example of that being done in the Pakistan Remittance Initiative. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.